With God of War, the engine took a major leap towards forward regarding its visual capabilities. Like most projects, the overhauling of Godot's render pipeline forced to make many or thousands of little decisions going forward with the future of the render pipeline. And today, John Clay is here, the leader of the rendering team of the Godot engine, who will tell us about the future of the render pipeline in Godot and the many great visuals that will come from it. So, applause for Clay.
Thanks everyone, and thanks for the nice introduction. I'm feeling very welcome to be here, and I hope everybody feels welcome here. As you said, we've been really busy. We've been working super hard these last couple years to make Godot 4 everything that we wanted it to be, and it's good. I'm very happy with it, and I'm always looking forward to what's next, and unfortunately that means I always feel like things can be better. And so today I'm going to talk about what I think and what we've talked about and discuss what we think would make things better. And hopefully you agree. There will be a Q&A period afterwards, so feel free to ask questions about things you don't understand, and feel free to ask about things that you think we might have missed. If you have a lot of questions, you can always find me at lunch, and I'm more than happy to chat about this sort of stuff. So, for a little context, I started contributing to Godot in 2017. So at that point, we had released Godot 2.1. Godot 3.0 had not yet come out, and it was, you know, the big thing. It was going to change everything, and everything was going to be really advanced and really nice. And things have changed so much from then. Godot 3.5, and we'll be releasing Godot 3.6 soon, is just totally different from Godot 3.0. And now we have 4.0, we're about to release 4.2, and I think 4.6, 4.12 are going to be totally different, and I'm really hoping to see that same sort of progression that we've seen over the last 6 years or so. I'm going to talk a little bit about what I'm going to talk about, so that's fun. So first I want to talk a little bit about the current state of things as of 4.2. I mean, we've been releasing betas and we've been talking about what we've done so far, but I know a lot of people won't know exactly what's coming or what the state of things are, so I want to kind of introduce that. And then I want to talk about our priorities. And this is going to be a bit of a discussion about how we decide what our priorities are, how we decide what we're going to work on next, and how we kind of deal with conflicting needs and desires from the community. Then we're going to talk about short-term plans. So these are things that we've talked about. We're all fairly certain that they're things we want to have in the engine, and we want to have in the engine quite soon. And quite soon means, you know, maybe 6 months, maybe a year. We'll get working on them soon and hopefully have something that's ready and merged into the engine in a shorter, more reasonable timeline. And then finally, I want to talk about some long-term ideas. And you can see I don't call these plans, I call these ideas, because they're things that we're talking about, but we don't know if we'll actually do them. We don't know if when we do them, they'll look anything like what we have in mind now, but they're the sorts of things that we're thinking about and talking about because we want to be ready for the next generation of things and for the future, and we want to make sure that we're thinking about our future now so that we don't get ourselves into a position where we have to go back and rewrite everything again, because that's essentially what we did already for Godot 4, and we don't want to do that again. So, important disclaimer, I'm talking about new features today. That doesn't mean that that's our focus going forward. We are still totally dedicated to working on bug fixes, stabilizing things, making things run faster, making things easier. It's just that for a talk, it's more fun to talk about new features. So that's what I'm going to talk about, but don't take any of this to mean that we're not totally dedicated to fixing the things that are currently broken or smoothing out the things that are a little bit bumpy right now. Okay, so the current state of things. As most of you will know, we've got a few different rendering backends. So we've got what we call the RD renderer, and the RD renderer is our Vulkan-based renderer. It's for modern systems. It works well on newer phones. It works well on desktop devices. It doesn't run on the web. It doesn't run on 10-year-old devices. And for that, we have the compatibility backend. And the compatibility backend is very similar to the old good old GLES2 renderer. It's not GLES2, it's GLES3, but the architecture is very similar to the GLES2 renderer. And so the state of that is it's mostly done. The 2D render is totally done. It's very fast. It works really well. And for 2D games that are targeting mobile, low-end desktop, web, it's working quite well, and we're very happy with it. But for 3D, there's still more we want to do. So some of the more advanced 3D features that you might not use all the time, we haven't implemented yet. And I'm going to talk more about that and what our plans are for it later. But for now, just know that it's not 100% where we want it to be in terms of features. But it's getting there and should be there fairly soon. And then for the RD backends, this is our high-end stuff, right? This is the exciting stuff. This is where the new features go, because this is targeting higher-end devices. It's targeting more recent devices. Okay, we're having microphone problems. Okay, so that's the RD backends. We're quite happy with where they are. So things are performing okay. Things are looking really good, and I know you're going to see some demos later this weekend that look really good, so be excited for that. But we know performance can be better. We're working on it. For some scenes it's great. For other scenes we need to do a bit more work. And then certain effects are not up to the quality that we want them to be. And you know, this is a time constraint kind of thing. We get things working so that 90% of the time it looks good, and then if your game falls into that 10%, it looks terrible and doesn't work at all, and we need to do a lot of work, and we're getting there. And then finally, the last thing, and this is a bit more technical, but we right now use a very rigid rendering pipeline. So what that means is we make certain assumptions about how your game should be rendered, so what order the steps happen in, what sort of things are going to be done. And this is nice for us as developers, because we just say, okay, A, B, C, D, that's the order that things happen in, and then we're good. Things are fast, we can optimize for that. But then if your game doesn't fit into what we have in mind, then all of a sudden you run into barriers, and you're like, well, I want to do this. And we smile and say, no, you can't, sorry. Or, you know, well, I'm doing this thing that seems so simple. Why is it performing slow? And we go, oh, yeah. That is going to perform slow, but this will be fast. And you say, well, I don't want to do that. I want to do the thing that I'm already doing. No, it's going to be slow. Sorry. Good luck. So we want to provide more flexibility. We want to provide the tools so that users who are really pushing Godot can tweak things or really control things that they want to control. And that'll allow people to get really high performance when they need it, and really flexible kind of alternative styles and things when they want to do it. But this is subject to the constraint that for regular users, we want regular users to just be able to not worry about any of that stuff and just have things work, which is the state now. For most people, you just throw all your stuff in, it works, you don't think about it, and you move on. Okay, so talking about priorities. So following up on that, number one priority is ease of use, right? It's something that makes Godot really unique. You don't need years of experience as a game dev to start using it. You can just start using it and things work. And then when you get more experience, you learn new things and you're able to push it further and further. And that's what we want to keep. We don't want to sacrifice that early core experience in order to make people, you know, be able to make really big games or really, you know, different things. We want to make sure that that core experience stays the same, and then it's also possible to do something more advanced or do something really big once you know more and you know how to take advantage of the tools that that are available. And then next up are stability and performance. So I touched on those before, but like for a game engine, these are just of the utmost importance. And of course, they're things that we find extremely important too, right? So your game needs to run. It needs to run as fast as possible so that you can do as much as you want. And it needs to actually work on all the devices that you want to ship on. And we care about that too, because we ship Godot to every Godot user because the Godot editor is Godot. And so our users need Godot to work well, and our users need their games to work well. And those two things are really closely aligned. And so we tend to spend a lot of time trying to stabilize and make things work well. So now these are priorities that we're thinking more about going into the future. They don't reflect how we've been making decisions. They're more reflecting how we're making decisions about what we do next. So I've already touched on this quite a bit, but we want the engine to be more flexible. We want more advanced users to be able to do more diverse things with the engine, and we really want to empower those users to do the things that they want to do. And for that, the engine needs to be more flexible. So in terms of rendering, that means things like custom rendering passes. If you don't know what that is, I'm going to talk about it later, so I won't spend any time on that now. And we want users to have more powerful shader authoring. So right now we have a very, what I think is a very approachable way of authoring shaders. It's a lot easier than just getting started with raw GLSL or a shader language, but it's limiting. And so we want to provide something that's less limiting and gives power users more control. And then the other thing is scale. So when you're making a 3D game in Godot, you can only make the game so big. There are technical limitations for that I'll talk about later, and then I'll talk about what our solutions for that are, and in particular how we're going to do that without making small games extremely hard to make. Because right now, if you're making a small game, it's super easy. If you're making a huge game, it's extremely hard. We want to keep small games easy to make, but we want to make it possible to make large games as well. So that's just larger scenes, primarily. Okay, so now this is the process piece, right? So we have a lot of ideas. A lot of us have diverse experience in the industry. We're coming from different places. We think we know what should be prioritized. And so we meet a lot and we talk about things. We write blog posts and proposals. We go on social media and we talk about what we think we should work on. And then we listen to people. It's easier to say than to do, but we really try to stay engaged with people. And again, this is in our meetings. We have public weekly meetings that people can come to and talk, and we get a lot of feedback on our blog posts. So we try to write lots of blog posts so that we get more feedback. We get a lot of feedback on our chat platform. We get a lot of feedback on social media. And so we really try to engage with people and understand what their needs are. And how we can solve their needs in a way that makes sense within Godot. And in doing that, we have to prioritize certain things because we have conflicting things. Some users are saying, I want to make Assassin's Creed in Godot. Please make that possible for me. And we say, okay, we'll try. We'll do what we can. But ultimately, the needs that we spend the most time on are when people say, I'm making this game, I'm partway through my project, and I'm running into this limitation. And I cannot finish my game unless this is lifted. Everything else, everything works great in Godot, but I'm running into this thing. What can we do? And that gets super high priority, right? Because we want to focus on the known needs of our current users. And we're really trying to avoid the speculation of, hey, I'd love to use Godot, but it has to support this, or else I won't touch it. And then we implement that thing, and they don't come anyway. So now we're just maintaining a feature that nobody uses. So we really want to implement things that we know people are going to use. The people who are using the engine know they're going to use it. And that, for us, is ideal. And so that's why these three things are up top, right? To me, this is the way of serving our current users, right? We make things easy to use. We make sure that our current users are empowered. Things are performing well so that they can make the things they want to make, and we make sure that everything we have works well. And then this is about expanding things for our current users and for future users. So now you can hopefully do things that weren't possible before. You can make the game that you wanted to make, but you've been keeping on the back burner because it's just not going to work with Godot. But ultimately, we have to deal with these conflicting demands, and it can feel a little bit like this. So on the one hand, you have users with like incredible systems because they're software engineers, and so they've got the best computers and everything, and they're using Godot and they want all the fancy effects. And then we've got a lot of people that are working on laptops or older systems, especially people in the second and third world that use Godot. They don't have NVIDIA graphics cards, and they certainly don't have the 4090. And so for them, like, we could implement ray tracing, but it does nothing for them. And it takes a lot of time for us. So we try to find a balance between these things. Ultimately, we do our best to support both sides here, because next gen features today are totally standard features, and next year, right? So we want to support those things. We want to support them in a decent amount of time, but we're doing that within the constraint of making sure that we are helping everybody. So this is a slide from our 2023 poll, and what you can see is the high end, this is specific for GPUs, but the high end devices only make up about a third of our current user base. And we had about 8,000 response. Oh, you can see 7,671. It's a pretty good, I think, representation of the community. And so if we focus on low end features or medium end features, we're serving two thirds of the community. And if we focus on high end features, we're serving one third. So that's it's a significant amount either way, so we have to focus on everything a little bit, but it does help us decide what we're doing. And this goes without saying that we also have a lot of mobile users, so we can debate having high and medium end features, but on mobile devices, like the current gen on desktop is going to be current gen on mobile in 10 years, right? So to properly support mobile, we need to be thinking about next gen and last gen, and we need to make sure that everything works well, and we can't just abandon a huge part of our user base. So this is, again, from the poll this year. You can see 35% of the community is targeting web, 32% Android, 9% iOS, and everybody targets Windows on top of that. But this is an important part of our community, and we don't want to leave them behind, and we don't want to just focus on things that only a subset of our users can work on. So with the process out of the way, these are a few of the things that we think we'll be starting to work on very soon. Some of this we've started work on and expect to have finished soon. Some of it we're hoping to start soon, and we'll see when it gets finished. So I promise to come back to the compatibility backend. This is near and dear to my heart. So we're working on some of what we consider to be the more advanced effects. So in particular, things that we'd like to work on soon are SSAO, that's screen space ambient occlusion. It's responsible for making corners a little bit dark. It adds a lot of realism to your games. I promise, if you don't know what that is, if you do know what it is, I trust that you're excited. Volumetric fog, we have that supported in the RD renderers. We're going to implement it for the compatibility backend, but in a different way, in a way that's not going to look quite as nice. Right now, the volumetric fog in Godot is very crisp, it's extremely fast, and it looks amazing. And on the compatibility backend, it's not going to look as good, it's not going to be as physically accurate, but it's going to run on low-end devices, and it's going to run in the compatibility backend, and so we're quite excited about that. And then Glow, of course, we're all familiar with Glow, and we love it. And then on top of that, things like reflection probes, light maps, these are things that you need for 3D games. They're not supported, so the types of 3D games you can make in the compatibility renderer, it's still quite limited, and they're things that we'll implement as soon as possible. And we're going to implement them from the user-facing perspective as similar as we can to the RD renderers, but ultimately they're going to be using less accurate versions, more optimized versions of things that are much better on that hardware, so they're not going to look quite as good, but they're going to be fast, and that's our priority for the compatibility backend. Now, this is my favorite slide. I'm going to go through it really fast because it's all technical stuff. I have a lot of notes written here, and I'm not going to cover it all. So the acyclic graph, this is extremely exciting for me. This is a tool that solves a very specific problem that we have in the Vulkan backend that I hope nobody here knows that we have. But it's a problem for me, and so this is something that's going to make the life of rendering engineers better. And ultimately, what it's doing is it's something that runs behind the scenes. It keeps track of all the GPU commands and GPU resources that we use, and then it reorders all of the commands to make sure that everything that can run in parallel runs in parallel, things that need to wait on other things properly wait on other things. And what it means for us and for users who are using the rendering device directly is they don't have to worry about parallelizing their GPU code. They don't have to worry about putting barriers in between different commands. You just tell Godot what you want to do, and it'll reorder things so that it's as fast as possible and just works. So it's going to make the experience for rendering engineers a lot more comfortable. And it should come with a lot of performance benefits too. Naturally, this is going to improve GPU performance, but it's going to cost a little bit of CPU cycles. So we'll be tweaking it to find a good balance, but it's something that we think is going to make a lot of things just work very, very easily, and the cost should be quite minimal. Now, this is a problem, a really big problem. Vulkan and the modern APIs introduced a concept called pipelines. Pipelines are a thing that bundles together everything you need to know about rendering before you render something. So it's got your shader, it's got your material info, it's got your blend mode, things like that. A problem that we see in pretty much every game that releases these days is the first time an object comes onto screen, you get a bit of a stutter. And like AAA studios are struggling with this, we're struggling with this. Back in the old days of using OpenGL, there was no good solution for this. We came close to a solution, but in the end it only worked on some GPUs with certain drivers and really only on newer stuff. And it's still a problem today with Vulkan. So we've got some ideas that we can do in order to reduce this, and that is quite complex, but it's similar to what we did in Godot 3, which is using what we call an Uber shader approach, and then compiling pipelines in the background. If you want to talk more about that, come find me later. It's a very technical topic, very exciting for me, but not well suited for today. And last, we will hopefully soon start work on a metal renderer. So Metal is the equivalent of Vulkan, but it runs on Apple devices. We have a translation layer that translates Vulkan to Metal, and it works. That's about it. It works, but it's not as fast as we want it to be. It comes with a lot of problems, and it's super hard to debug. So we want to write a Metal backend. We have the infrastructure there. We just need to do it. Okay, and now something more exciting. So the compositor is our solution to customizing rendering. So a compositor is something that organizes rendering passes, and what that means in practice is it's something that allows users to control the order that rendering happens in. So we've got some tools in Godot to control the order of things, but they're not perfect. And I'll explain what that means. So right now, if you want to render something in Godot, you start from a viewport. The viewport renders the camera, and then you do this step called culling. So that's anything that the camera can't see is just thrown out. If you have occlusion culling turned on, it's like things that are hidden behind other surfaces are also thrown out. And then we go to render the scene. And that looks kind of like this. So we do a pre-pass, then we do a TAA pass. So that's objects that are moving, and they need to write out to special buffers for TAA. Then we do an opaque pass, we draw the sky, and then we draw transparent objects on top. The TAA pass and the opaque pass are where all your opaque objects are drawn. So that's most of your objects. The trouble is, for certain effects, you want something to be rendered first, or you want it to be rendered last. And right now, you can kind of do that. You can use what we call the render priority setting and give it a high priority. But if you want something rendered first and it's in the opaque pass, it's going to be rendered after everything in the TAA pass. So it actually ends up rendering somewhere in the middle. And vice versa, if you want something to be rendered last, but it's dynamic, the best you can do is the middle. You can't make it render last. So the solution that we've come up for this using the compositor is to allow users to create their own custom passes. So that looks kind of like this. So you'll do your depth pre-pass, then you do TAA pass 1, opaque pass 1, and then TAA pass 2, opaque pass 2. So if I want something to be rendered first, I put it in pass 1 and it renders, and then everything else can be in the other passes, and then rendering continues as normal. So this is something that's extremely important for using stencils, for using custom depth testing, for implementing terrain blending, which is a important feature if you want to have a modern terrain system. It's used for geometry decals and other custom effects. So I'll give an example of this. A common problem that users have is you want to render a boat, and you've got a water plane, and water fills your boat. And of course, the GPU doesn't understand that water should not be inside a boat, so users have to come up with all kinds of different ways of making sure the water is not drawn where the boat is, and that can be really annoying. And so GPUs have a tool for this called stencils. And so what stencils allow you to do is you write to a special buffer, the stencil buffer, and that draws the boat. And then when you go to draw the water, you just say, don't draw where the boat is. And the boat will have an ID, like maybe 1. And so then you get something like this. This is actually from a Unity project. It's an because we don't support stencils yet. Which is why I'm talking about this. But it's actually a pretty cool project. It's a totally open source, community-driven demo project. It was unfortunately canceled, but it's still pretty cool, and I'm happy it exists. So that's our solution for this problem. But the compositor does more than that, because there are other effects that users want to do, and you sometimes want to do more than just adding another opaque pass, because obviously there are more things in your scene than opaque objects. Sometimes you want to render, for example, portals or mirrors, where you're rendering the scene again from a different angle, but you want it to render to the same viewport. You don't want to render to another viewport and then copy everything over, because that's needlessly expensive. So this is, again, the high level of what rendering looks like. You go through rendering your camera, culling, render scene, and appears there. And then we want users to be able to do this. Render your camera, cull, render scene, and then before you do post-processing and copy to the 2D renderer, we'll just do that all again. We'll do it with a different camera. And you can do really fancy effects like portals combined with stenciling, where you only render the area that's in the portal. And then you can render a portal really efficiently, really easily, and it should work well. And obviously, look at all these little boxes. This is an advanced thing, but those are advanced effects, right? And so this is an example of a situation where We're trying to keep the normal process for users the same, and then we're adding something advanced so users who really want to do those things can do it. It's going to take a little bit of knowledge, and it's going to be a little bit more complex, but you'll be able to do it, and ideally we're going to have some really good tutorials and stuff in the future. So what you end up seeing here, if you're rendering with multiple cameras, is you end up doing this full pass twice, and that allows you to do a lot of things. And then, of course, if in the second pass you're not rendering a sky, it doesn't render the sky. And if you don't have transparent objects, it doesn't render transparent objects either. And then something I'm not going to talk about, because I want to get through the presentation within my time slot, is we're also going to allow inserting callbacks between these passes. And so that'll allow you to write GD script code or C# code or whatever scripting language you use. And then you can insert code between the passes in order to, you know, add new rendering commands that we wouldn't be putting in there. And that, so that allows you to script the pipeline a little bit. It's not a scriptable rendering pipeline, but it allows you to do some things you wouldn't be able to do otherwise. So on to shader templates. So this is what a shader looks like in Godot. Like I said before, we keep things simple. You write to some specified outputs, you have some specified inputs, and all of those come from our big shader. So we maintain shaders that are thousands of lines of code so that your shaders can be tens of lines of code. But ultimately what happens is we take your shader code and we just shove it into ours. So that's the whole shader I showed before, and now it's sitting within our shader. And so what it means is you are kind of stuck with the decisions that we make about the shader, right? If we make the shader slower to make it more correct or make it look a little bit better, you just have to live with that decision because your code gets inserted into ours. And what we want users to be able to do is not make the same trade-offs we're making. We want users to be able to make their own trade-offs. We want users to be able to implement their own shaders so that they can do whatever they want. So, you know, the big question is, what do we do about all this stuff? Until now, it's been necessary. So that's what the idea behind shader templates are. They're the everything else around your shader. So our idea is we'll have a new resource type. It'll be shader template. When you assign it to your material, instead of using the Godot template, for lack of a better word, you'll use your own. And ideally what you can do with that is implement totally different rendering styles. Like if you want to, for example, write a toon shader where you accumulate all the lights and then you apply a stepping function to the accumulated lights, this is a heavily requested feature, by the way, you can do that. And then for other users who don't care about that, we don't need to add weight to the shaders to support that. You can do it yourself. The idea is this is something you could specify in a world environment or on a material or on a shader itself, and then it'll just work. And then also, of course, if you want, you can just delete 90% of our shader code and have super fast shaders because you know exactly what you want, and what you want is to render a lot of things even faster than you can normally. Now this is a fun topic. You can already see what's going to happen here. We've worked really hard on improving our TAA in the coming up to 4.2. And now what we want to do is leverage that really good TAA in order to optimize a bunch of effects like GI, AO, shadows. So this is an example of the difference that using TAA makes on shadows. This actually didn't make it into 4.2, but it should be merged for 4.3. So you can see up top, the shadows look a little bit blocky. Here that is close up. And then with TAA optimization, that's what it looks like. So we're hoping to apply that to SSAO, to our GI, and what that means is if you are okay with this, you can just turn your quality settings to the lowest, make shadows super fast, and then you get a free performance boost. And if you're not okay with this, then you can have this. And then it also allows us to move to some more modern techniques. So this is SSAO. It adds the little dark spots and cracks. On the left is what we currently use in Godot. This isn't a screenshot from Godot, by the way, but it's the same technique. That's what we currently use. And then on the right is a more modern version of the same technique. So it looks a little bit nicer, a little bit crisper, and it takes about 70% of the time to render. So it's faster, it looks better, we want it. Okay, now this is a fun buzzword a lot of people will be familiar with. Deferred rendering. Godot uses a forward renderer, which means that we render our lights at the same time that we render an object. I'm not going to go any deeper into it than that. What a deferred renderer does is you render the information about your objects to the screen, and then you take all of that and you render your lights after. So you combine those slices and then render your lights. Realistically, this is a performance optimization. It's something you do when you want to have a lot of lights in the scene and you want to have really complex shaders. Forward renderers struggle with something called VGPR usage, and the solution, unfortunately, is to write a different type of renderer. So we'd like to have an option that you can toggle to turn on deferred rendering. It's less flexible. In certain cases, it's more difficult to use, but for people who know what they're doing, turning it on should just improve performance in a lot of cases. So it's an option we want to create, and we've set up our architecture so that it shouldn't be too onerous to add this. So we'd also be getting rid of the depth prepass, which is another performance saving tool. We'd provide access to these buffers to VFX artists. So there are a lot of cool techniques that people are familiar with from Unity and Unreal, and they want to implement them in Godot, and we say, sorry, you can't. We're a fundamentally different type of renderer. By adding this, we would unblock a lot of those people. And then we'd also unblock some other rendering techniques that just don't work in Godot right now. So one of those is something called deferred decals. It's also sometimes called mesh decals. What it allows you to do, it's a very cheap way of adding detail onto things. So a lot of times this is used to like add screws onto sheet metal without rendering, you know, 100,000 polygon screw. You can just throw it on top and it'll look quite good. Okay, and this is kind of what the process looks like when you use a deferred renderer. So you start with some basic information, you calculate lighting, which is the bottom left there, and then you put it all together. And it ends up looking the same as it would in Godot's forward renderer. Okay, so another kind of technical-ish thing, maybe something people are familiar with, streamable resources. So this is mesh streaming and texture streaming. And so the idea there is, instead of loading the entire model and your 4K textures at once, you start with the low-res textures, and you start with the low polygon version of the model, and then you scale up in accordance with maybe how close things are to you, with time, and with how much VRAM you have. So this is an optimization for larger game worlds, but it's an optimization we're increasingly finding that our users need, because people are adding more detail, they're having nicer meshes, and they're having larger textures, and they're bumping up on limits. Ultimately, what this does, importantly, it decreases load time. So if you're switching between different scenes, it makes that quite a bit faster. And it allows you to manage VRAM effectively. So for those of you making bigger games, you know that in Godot, once you put too many things into your 3D world at once, and you go over the card's VRAM limit, things get really slow. And your only option is to start removing stuff as fast as you can. And we don't have an automatic process for that. This would allow you to set a limit that says, this card has 4 gigabytes of VRAM, do not go over that limit, and then the engine can manage memory for you and make sure you don't go over the limit. And that's important for scenes like this. It doesn't look too complex, it's kind of stylized, it's really nice, but when you actually look at the detail required for something like this, you can see there's a lot going on. So, like, you know, these are high resolution textures. They look amazing up close and from far away. And This is a really high polygon model, and if you want to render this efficiently, you have to have some form of streaming. And of course, we're all familiar with streaming bugs, so we're looking forward to introducing these into Godot as well. This is the downside of streaming. If you've got a slow hard drive or if you've got limited VRAM, then suddenly your cutscenes might look like this for a second or two. Here's another famous example. I think this is on a PS4, and that's an important character as far as I know. Okay, moving on. We're always working on polishing our VFX pipeline. These days we're getting really good feedback, really detailed feedback, and there are a ton of paper cuts for VFX artists. There's a ton of room for growth in this area, and people are already creating super, super cool things. So this is a screenshot. I pulled this from a PR coming in Godot 4.2 from Cubichet that really improves a lot of our particle systems. And so we're working on improving this stuff. We want VFX artists to have more control, obviously, more flexibility, but this is an iterative process. So we get feedback, we fix a paper cut, we get more feedback, and then as we resolve things, we have a much more clear direction of where to go in the future. And so this is a kind of a baby step situation where we're finding our way by slowly moving towards our end goal. Okay. Pretty stuff. SDFGI. SDFGI stands for Signed Distance Field Global Illumination. What it is, it's our dynamic solution to bouncing lighting off of things and into other places. So here is what a scene looks like without SDFGI turned on. And then when you turn it on, it looks like this. So notice how you get the darkness inside the castle, because the only light getting in there should be what comes in through the teeny tiny windows, the door, and that's it. So it gets much, much darker. This is how SDFGI sees the world. This is a visualization of the signed distance field. So you kind of take a simplified version of the scene. You use it to calculate lighting, which is, this is just the lighting contribution from SDFGI, and then you put that together and that's what you get. So this is the perfect case for SDFGI. I think it looks amazing. It runs super fast, and it works really well. But that scene is a scene that is an ideal candidate for SDFGI. So it's got a big light source. It's got nice chunky geometry. And the performance is good, but we know we can make it better. And then particularly where SDFGI struggles is when you're inside a closed room and you have a small light source, then things look a little bit wonky, and we know we can improve that, and so we are going to do that. And we're going to do that by improving SDFGI. We're to have better performance. We're gonna add more accuracy. So this is a weird visualization about how we do that. And it's by separating our data into a few different formats, and then we're gonna do some trickery with the UN64 format in order to get more accuracy. We're hoping this will eliminate light leaks. And then on top of that, we want to add dynamic object support. So before I called it a dynamic system, it's dynamic in the sense that when you move the sun, all the lighting changes, but it doesn't capture lighting from, for example, your character who's carrying a lantern or something around. The contribution from the person won't be there. You'll just have the lighting from the lantern, and that can be a bit problematic. Okay, so I'm running short on time, so I'm going to blast through these and then open the floor for questions. These are some of our long-term ideas. So we've been talking about ray tracing, we've been talking about a GPU-driven renderer, and we've been talking about writing a pluggable renderer through GD extension. So if you're not familiar with ray tracing, it's really a new technology that's not going anywhere, and it's the future of rendering. We'd like to introduce some effects using ray tracing, starting with shadows, GI, reflections. We're talking about eventually having a ray tracing-based renderer, and this just allows us to get closer to ground truth, which is, you know, realistic looking stuff, but it's a very long-term plan for us, and it has to fit in with our plans for GPU-driven renderer. Now, this is another modern technique. It's been around for 10 years or so. It's used in all the big kind of games. It allows you to write things faster. It allows you to stress your GPU a little bit more, and it works really well combined with ray tracing. So we're talking about how we can make something like this in a way that doesn't take too many resources away from other developments, and as such, it's a very long timeline for us to get something like this. And then finally, we want to have a pluggable renderer through GD extension. So the idea there is you would write your own renderer, compile it into a GD extension, and then, you know, you could ship that out, you could put it on the asset library, and then people could just plug in a totally different renderer. So maybe something that's optimized for non-photorealistic rendering, or something that's optimized for a specific type of asset or a specific style, and you would just skip everything that we've written and all the work that we've done, and use your own thing. And that's something we want to support, but we know it's going to be a lot of work, and it's going to be hard to do right. So it's a long-term thing for us. Okay, any questions?
Rand?
So yes, I'm going to be very eager. I have two questions, if that's okay. First of all, you mentioned having sets of passes where one set could end and lead into another set starting. Could that lead to a situation where a frame essentially never finishes rendering because it's stuck in an infinite loop of rendering sets?
No. You specify how many passes you want to do in advance, and you specify what goes in each pass. So there's a limited number that you can have, and you choose what that number is.
Hello, I'm curious why vertex lighting wasn't implemented in 4.0, and was it because of priority, or why? Because there are many mobile devs and also some devs that like to do retro-styled graphics like me or like HP-S1, and yeah.
Yeah, that's a good question, and the answer is unfortunately a bit long, so I'll give you the short answer, and it's limited resources, A, and the difference between our hired resources and community resources. So for certain things that are more medium priority and that take less technical skill to implement, we kind of wait until somebody from the community does it, because we want to be able to engage those resources. If we ourselves, the hired team, do everything that's easy, then there's nothing left for the community to do. And so that's something that just unfortunately took a long time, but should be coming in 4.3.
So there's someone that implements it, there's a PR, and could it be re-edited to 4.2, or is it like too late for that?
It's too late, unfortunately. Our goal is to release 4.2 in the next couple weeks. So it came in kind of after we had frozen features and we were in late betas, so it's something that's coming soon, but not next week.
Sorry, me again. The RD renderer, is that targeted specifically towards PC hardware, or are there considerations, or do there need to be considerations for it to be suitable for consoles, Xbox, particularly the Switch?
So the RD renderers actually run on almost all of our supported platforms. The only exception right now is web. So they run over Vulkan, which is supported on some consoles. And it's supported on desktop and mobile. Soon, browsers are going to ship web GPU, which will allow us to run the RD renderer over web. And then the RD renderer also abstracts over D3D12, Metal, secret console APIs that we can't talk about. So the RD renderer will run everywhere. And the compatibility renderer will only run places that run OpenGL. So that it's slightly more limited, but right now it's what supports mobile and web the best.
Three more questions, and I have one from this side, I guess.
So you mentioned being able to write custom shader templates. So are those going to be written in like the usual shader language that Godot uses, or are those like GLSL?
They'll be raw GLSL, which our shader language is raw GLSL with a few things added on top of it. So we're hoping that the it's not too difficult for users, but it is a very advanced feature, and it's intended for advanced users. So it's not going to be quite as easy as what we currently offer with GD shaders.
Yeah, thank you. You didn't talk about Direct3D, and there is a PR for it, and what is the plan with that?
The plan for Direct3D was to merge it for 4.2, but we decided not to in the end, as there was some tweaks we wanted to make, and we want to make sure that once it lands in upstream, it's exactly how we want it to be. And unfortunately, being such a large feature that comes with hundreds of thousands of lines of code, we need to prioritize making sure that Godot itself remains lean and mean and easy to build and easy to work with. And so merging something that's hundreds of thousands of lines of code actually takes a lot of process for us. Technically, it works. You can merge the PR into your own branch, and it works great. But we want to figure out some things on the Git side and on the process management side to make it actually feasible for us to ship builds with D3D enabled. And so that just took a bit more time than we expected. So it. Yes.
Can you repeat it, Clay? Can you repeat what he said, just please?
Heim Peter said, "This is a fun building to talk about D3D 12 issues in." Because there are unfortunately process issues around merging Microsoft code into an open source project.
Oh.
Not well, that we're not thankful.
We don't have to go into this here. Is there one last question? We have time for one last question if somebody wants to know something. Yep. I go to you.
Thank you. So if you allow people to plug into the rendering pipeline at various points, that will that also mean that you are less flexible in the future about changing how that pipeline works, because now people are dependent on the particular shape and the order things are happening in?
Yeah, that's right. And that's one of the reasons why we've held off for so long on doing something like this, because ultimately the callback the user receives is going to have a set of inputs and a set of outputs, and now we can't change those. We can add more inputs, we can add more outputs, but we can't take anything away. So if we decided that for example, for the performance of our default rendering pipeline, we want to totally remove some buffer, we have to figure out some way of maintaining that for users who are using it. So it's something that takes a long time to add, because we need to be confident that the way things are, we're going to be happy with in 5 years, and that's a hard thing to do. But yeah, that's a great question. We are quite a bit more limited now in the changes we can make.
Thank you very much, Clay.
Thank you.